In 1980, the 14th Winter Olympics were held in Lake Placid, New York. The great showdown and highlight of the games was the hockey match between the Soviet Union and the USA team in the medal round. The Soviet Union had won the gold medal in 5 of the 6 previous Winter Olympic Games, and they were the favorites going into this Olympic season to once again win in Lake Placid. The Soviet team consisted of what amounted to professional players. At that time, the status of any athlete was supposed to be an amateur status, meaning not paid for it, but the way the Soviets ran their team, they were essentially professionals, and they had a great deal of experience on the international arena playing. By contrast, the United States team was the youngest team in tournament history and the youngest U.S. national team in history. They were all unknowns. Both teams came into this match, however, unbeaten, and as the match began, the first period ended with a tied score of 2-2. In the second period, the Soviets led by getting another goal, and then ultimately the U.S. team scored 2 more goals in the third quarter to take their first lead during the game, and then won by a score of 4-3. Following the game, the U.S. went on then to win the gold medal by beating Finland in the final medal round, and the Soviets took silver by beating Sweden. That victory became a very iconic moment of the Olympic Games and U.S. sports, and it took on the name the Miracle on Ice. In 1999, Sports Illustrated named the Miracle on Ice the top sports moment of the 20th century. As part of its centennial celebration in 2008, the International Ice Hockey Foundation named the Miracle on Ice the best international hockey story of the past 100 years. Everybody loves a story where the underdog wins. But life doesn't seem to play out that way all the time, does it? On a daily basis, it seems those with power, those with money, those willing to bend or even break the rules seemingly win all the time. Oftentimes, this can come at the expense of the common man, as it seems. King David, regularly wrote on this topic. He lamented regularly how the wicked seemed to prosper. And in considering putting some of those psalms in my sermon today, I had to just decide not to do that. There were so many of them. I'll just reference one for your notes if you'd like. Psalm 73, verse 3. For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. In this world, it's the strong who regularly consume the weak. Or is it? Today I'm going to challenge the view we can have at times as seeing ourselves as underdogs. We are capable of conquering the giants in our lives. And so my sermon title today is We Are Underdogs. I'd like to begin by giving the story that perhaps of one of the greatest underdog stories in Scripture at least, but certainly even in history, King David and his encounter with Goliath. King David is seen as probably the antithesis of the underdog. He was certainly so in his early life. He was not considered kingly material. In fact, in his own family, he wasn't even considered worthy to see Samuel when Samuel was looking for a king. It seems that David was on the smaller side, not a big man. Certainly was not handsome. He's called ruddy in Scripture, and certainly not handsome like King Saul was. By training, he was a shepherd. And because he was a shepherd, he was a poet. Not somebody, as you would think, would be qualified to encounter somebody like Goliath. But there were skills that he learned in protecting his flocks that served him well later in life as a military man. But while he was still a teenager, we have this account. This is 1 Samuel 17. This account is perhaps the most well-known of his life. His success over Goliath, the ultimate story of an underdog winning. But this happened during the reign of King Saul, as I mentioned. Israel was once again at war with the Philistines. And when David comes on the scene there in that battle, the armies were at a stalemate. Israel on one side of the valley and the mountains, the Philistines on the other side of the valley and the mountains, and they were simply taunting each other. They were not willing to engage militarily. This valley is called the Elah Valley. If you look it up on a map of that area, that time period, it was just south of Jerusalem, just north of Bethlehem. And this valley ran east-west. What the Philistines were attempting to do was to capture this valley and that mountain range by extension And in doing so, they would have cut Israel in half as a nation. And they could have easily controlled the half and pressed it the north. But what also happened during this time in antiquity is that oftentimes these nations would get in these stalemates. They would send out a champion. It seems odd to our modern way of looking at things, but their view was it required a lot of honor, but also it saved a lot of unnecessary death and loss of military might. And so they would send out these champions. While this played out, neither wanted to expose themselves. The Israelites weren't hurried to engage the Philistines, and so you have this waiting game. And while this was going on, David then was sent by his father to take supplies to his brother. Again, not worth considering to go into battle, but worth taking things up to the battle. But as David approached and he heard these various things of derision from Goliath towards the God of Israel, he was moved to address this. He couldn't just stand by and not do anything. And so then, as it's recorded, David convinced Saul to let David represent the nation as the champion. I always found that very interesting. Here's David, and for all the things we've talked about, probably an older teenager, very small in stature, not a military man by training on any level. And it just shows to me how uncertain Saul and the armies were that they allowed somebody like David to represent them. But David knew what he was doing. David did not go into this just as a whim, just without thinking about any of this. But let me highlight a few more things here first. Goliath, as I mentioned, was the champion of the Philistine forces, and he was literally a giant. Depending on what size cubit you accept, and it runs the spectrum, but it says in 1 Samuel 17:4 that Goliath was 6 cubits in a span tall. That would equate to somewhere between 9'6" and 11'10" tall. That's huge. Because of that size, it's been estimated that Goliath would have weighed around 700 pounds. That's a massive man. He needed to be that big because it's been estimated as well that his armor weighed around 175 pounds, just the armor, and that the size of the spear that is described, that the spearhead probably would have weighed around 15 pounds, just the spearhead. So you can see why no one in the Israel army was eager to engage Goliath. They were very intimidated by him. But what did David see that the rest of the army did not? He obviously wasn't looking at this in the same way. He didn't see Goliath as an unconquerable problem. After all, David had killed lions and bears with his hands and with a sword. He was not one that would shrink from this kind of encounter. And so David was initially fitted with Saul's armor. As they accepted him as their champion, they bring him in and they lay all this armor on him, and he ends up rejecting it because it's too heavy. It's too unfamiliar. He doesn't know how to use this. And so he takes it all off. The military men around David thought he was crazy for going into battle against this literal giant with no armor. But David wasn't fearful. If you read the account, he ran to meet Goliath, because he was convinced that God would deliver Goliath into his hands. But have you also maybe considered what contributed to David's success that day? Yes, he was eager. Yes, he thought he would be able to do this. And certainly his faith in God, his confidence in God, played a big part in this. But there was more. One big thing that we see in that account is that David didn't accept the limitations of the rules of war others were trying to put on him. Armor and spears and shields and these things. David rejected that. That was Goliath's war technique. That's why none of the other military men wanted to engage him in that way. He was the epitome of a warrior, Goliath was. But David did not go in without any strength, without any advantage. He went in with a huge advantage. What did he go in with? His sling. We don't think of a sling as being a very dangerous weapon, but it was extremely dangerous in the hands of a very qualified man. It has been estimated that sling bullets were known to penetrate armor. And it was because of how they're released. Most people picture a sling being this way over the head, and it's actually this way by your side. And so when it's released, it's literally like a bullet. It's a very flat trajectory, and it's very fast. It's been estimated that a skilled man could throw a sling bullet at speeds up to 100 miles an hour. You can see how that would penetrate armor. As the underdog, then, David refused to be constrained by the limitations others tried to impose upon him. He knew his strengths, and he used those to make Goliath's strengths his greatest weaknesses. Goliath, as I mentioned, was a huge man. He had weight and mass working against him. Anybody that knows physics knows that it takes a long time to move that kind of weight, that kind of mass. It is not going to be done quickly. David didn't have the armor, didn't have the size. He had speed on his side. He could move with the speed. Goliath was expecting a man that would come and engage in hand-to-hand combat or close enough to use a spear. David never allowed that. David could stay far enough away. The spear was of no use to Goliath because by the time he would throw it, David could simply move out of the way. David didn't need to fight close quarter. With that sling, he could stay outside of the distance of that range of spear. The physical strength that Goliath had became a non-issue. David was not at a disadvantage in fighting Goliath. In fact, David had the greatest of advantages. It can be easy for us to think that we're underdogs and then to allow that thought to dominate our thinking in a negative way. Let's take a look as we begin here at 1 Corinthians. We'll begin in verse 26. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. We think as underdogs that we're subject to being dominated by stronger outside forces. And sometimes we can read a verse such as this and we can say, well, yeah, look at what God has called, who God has called. So 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26, Paul writes, "For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise." We're, by the world's standards, not the best and the brightest, are we? We're not the movers and shakers. We're not the rich and the powerful. And we tend to think that means that we're less. But notice here that God is saying that the world, not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, according to those standards. But God doesn't call us weak. God doesn't call us foolish. Verse 27 again, he's chosen the foolish things of the world, not the foolish people. God has a different perspective, like David did. And notice the rest of verse 27, God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, that is, according to the world's standards. Verse 28, and the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not to bring to things those things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Did David look weak to Goliath? You bet. In fact, he called him a dog. Why have you sent this dog out to me? Probably by size, he didn't look much bigger than a dog to Goliath. Did that 1980 U.S. hockey team look weak to the rest of the sports world? Nobody expected them to make the medal round, let alone take the gold. In both cases, they used what others thought to be weaknesses and turned them into strengths that helped them to succeed. The world views God's people as weak. Satan views God's people as weak. Look at the encounter that's recorded for us in the book of Job. Satan had no expectation that Job had any kind of strength. He essentially said, look, he's weak. You take away your protection, he'll crumble. Take away the wealth you bless him with, he'll crumble. All these things that Satan was only looking at from his perspective. 1 Corinthians here acknowledges that we're weak compared to the world. But that is weakness God can help use to greater works. He says he's going to use it to confound the mighty. Like Goliath, like even Satan in that encounter with Job. So to finish the story of David, as you understand, as you remember, that first stone struck Goliath right between the eyes. Historians, theologians are at odds as to whether that actually killed Goliath or whether it just stunned him, made him unconscious. The net result didn't change. With him on the ground, David quickly ran up, pulled out Goliath's sword, and took off the head. So it doesn't matter at that point. David, in this one blow, routed the armies of the Philistines. And everyone was surprised, except for David. There's an interesting addendum to the story. How many stones did David pick up to take in his pouch? Five. He only used one. He didn't pick up four more to finish off Goliath. Goliath had four brothers. He was going to finish off the whole family. If you read later in 1 Samuel, others did that. David didn't. But that was the conviction that he had. David understood where his advantages were. Goliath was expecting, as I said, hand-to-hand combat. Goliath was expecting a seasoned veteran warrior. And so Goliath acted like everyone expected a warrior to act. David decided to engage his enemy on his own terms, and in doing so gave Goliath no advantage whatsoever. So in considering that, looking at the weak versus the strong, who we think have an advantage and who doesn't, how often do we think the bigger or the stronger side wins? That was some of what I ran through in my introduction. We think that the underdog loses on a regular basis. David lamented often, as I said, that the wicked seemed to prosper. But if you go and look through the Psalms, you'll see that he gave probably an equal number of verses that acknowledged that the weak are not going to prosper in the end. He knew that. But along this line, there's a political scientist named Ivan Aragon Toft. He studied this very question of how often the bigger side wins. So here's a little bit of audience participation. What do you guess that percentage is? How often does the underdog win compared to the big dog? Is it 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%? All right, only a few, and that's the same thing that happened this morning. What he found out was that 71.5% of the time, the stronger side wins, which means 28.5% of the time, the underdog wins. That's just a straight, flat-out confrontation. Not a huge number. Maybe it's bigger or smaller than you expected. But when Aragon Toft revised the question and studied how often the weaker side engaged as David did, that is, they refused to fight by the rules of the stronger, how often did the weaker side win? The weaker party's winning percentage climbed from 28.5% to 63.6%. The underdog wins regularly. We have examples of that. The U.S. colonists defeated the British Empire at the height of their power. Nobody expected that. How did they do that? They did it by refusing to fight the way the British fought. Lawrence of Arabia, some of you remember that name from history, trekked across most of northern Africa to take a strategic post that nobody thought could be conquered. But because he came in from the sands of the Sahara, nobody was looking for him. The Viet Cong forces versus the U.S. Army. Why did they succeed? Because they didn't engage. They didn't have the ability to engage the U.S. head-on with tanks and missiles and aircraft and all these things to the same level that we had. They changed the rules of war. The Afghan forces back in the 1980s with the Russian army. The Russians finally gave up and admitted defeat, something we haven't done to this day. In the 18th century, there's a French general, Maurice de Sales, famously said that the art of war was about legs, not arms. It's an interesting quote, and what he meant by that was that he was saying that a warrior who could outmaneuver or outpace an opponent would usually win over a superior military force. We think it's about overwhelming numbers, and it's not always. In fact, it rarely is. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 12 here. You and I can easily think that we're at a disadvantage. We're acutely aware of the trials, the difficulties, what Satan throws at us on a regular basis. We look at the world, we lament, we mourn at what mankind is doing to itself, to each other. We look at what God has promised, and we groan for that time of relief to come. And yet we still have something to do in the meantime. We're not forgotten. We're not so disadvantaged as we might think we are. And so in Hebrews 12 and verse 1, Paul here writes, he says, therefore, sort of summarizing from chapter 11, all those faithful that he recounts there, he says, we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight, whatever encumbers us. David knew that armor wouldn't serve him well. It had certain advantages. But that's not the fight he was going to fight. Paul here lays out a similar thing. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. And this is what the French general Maurice de Sales found out. War is not about legs, it's about arms. Excuse me, the other way around. Not about arms, about legs. So the American Indians understood this. They trained to outrun their horses. And they could do that. It's not as hard as you might think, because it's about endurance. A horse can sweat, but it can't process heat as efficiently as a human can. And so a human can actually outrun a horse over the course of a day. Paul's talking about this kind of race, not a sprint, something with endurance. It's about legs. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 9. Solomon acknowledged this in his own way here as well. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. It's not always to the fastest. We think it is. It's not. Especially when you're in an endurance race. What might look like an advantage initially may not be. Nor the battle to the strong. We can look at Satan and we can say, how can we fight someone such as that? He's spiritual. How do you even fight that at all? And yet he has all this power, all this ability, all these forces behind him. But God is reminding us here that the battle isn't always to the strong, nor bread to the wise, or riches to men of understanding, or favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. Those things can be as much a great weakness as they can be an attribute, depending on the situation. But again, how do you fight against Satan? Or how do you fight against the society? Or how do you fight against yourself, your own faults and weaknesses? Those can be giants as well. If we fight those things head on, how often do we win the battle using arrogant toss findings? Maybe 29% of the time? We engage directly head on the way Satan expects us to. But what if we fight an unconventional spiritual war as an underdog? Now, our odds have gone up to almost 64%. I'll take those odds. You're winning more than not. The race is not to the swift, because it doesn't have to be. But what are the giants you face? Sometimes it's easier, you know, in quotes, to face a giant like Goliath. Some of these other giants are harder to face. How do you face a boss that constantly berates you, or micromanages you, or undermines you? What about if you have a teacher or a professor that makes fun of your religious beliefs, threatens you, that if you take this time off in the fall, I'm going to flunk you for everything you miss? Or a family member that calls your beliefs and trust in God a sign of ignorance. Maybe your giant is a persistent or chronic health issue. Maybe it's an ongoing issue, struggle with finances, or maybe it's a persistent nagging sin that you need to overcome. But why do we so easily assume that our giants have an advantage against us and our battles are the giants to win? That's a defeatist attitude, isn't it? It's easy to think we'll lose the majority of our spiritual battles if we have a rigid and limited definition of what an advantage is. Our weakness and ability can be overcome with sheer effort in many cases. The race is not to the swift. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 12 next. Jeremiah faced this topic, this discussion we're having here, a little bit in his own way. The prophets of ancient Israel had a really hard calling. I am so glad God has not called me to be a prophet. You look at Jeremiah's life and he spent decades, literally decades. In fact, they knew the message he was going to bring every time he showed up. Oh yeah, here he comes. He's going to say this again. And it didn't change anything, did it? Not only did he just consistently do this to his credit, but it didn't change anything. He had more respect from the Babylonians than he did from the Israelites. And he's weary. And this is only chapter 12. And so he moans to God. Jeremiah 12, verse 5. And God replies here to him. He says, look, Jeremiah, if you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, then how can you contend with horses? Jeremiah, we haven't even started here yet. Jeremiah was looking at this from a direct confrontation viewpoint. He's looking at this and saying, how can I fight this? How can I go through this? And God, in his own way, is reminding Jeremiah here, you're looking at this the wrong way. How can you contend with the horses? And if in the land of peace, in which you have trusted, they have wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? Battles were held in valleys and plains. He's saying, look, if you can't do well in the foothills where it's harder to engage, how are you going to do it when it's the real deal? Endurance, determination, a willingness to put up with hardship, those are the tools of an underdog. Lawrence of Arabia, they had a pint of water a day to go across the desert. How could they do that? They could do it because they knew where the water was. They knew how to find it. They knew how to minimize the loss of it. So nobody expected them to come through the desert. That takes hardship, doesn't it? George Washington crossing the Delaware. Who in the world would have thought that they would have done it Christmas Eve with ice in the middle of the night? Nobody does that. Why would we fight a spiritual battle and let our opponent dictate the terms of the fight? It makes no sense. It's war. You don't let the enemy dictate the terms. The world says you can't succeed. You won't succeed if you obey God. You follow his laws. You won't succeed if you don't work on the Saturdays. You'll never advance in the company. All that overtime you'll miss out on. You can't get ahead if you tithe. Are you kidding me? 20% of your income? You won't succeed if you don't take advantage of people, if you're nice, if you're loyal, if you're kind. You got to be ruthless in business. No, that's their terms. If we try to fight our spiritual battles like the world does, then why do we think we would be any better than they are? We're going to fail like they fail. We're to be apart from the world. That's Revelation 18. Come out of her, my people. Don't do the things they do. That was 1 Corinthians 1. The world thinks we're foolish. Why do they think we're foolish? Because we don't behave like the world. We don't believe what the world believes. That looks stupid to them. But what that does mean is that we're going to fight our spiritual battles on God's terms. We're going to fight them as underdogs with the advantages that he has given us. Let's look at another example in Judges chapter 6. This is just a brief look at Gideon. Gideon is another one of those great underdog stories. Gideon didn't want to be a military leader. He didn't want to be a leader at all. He was trying to hide from the Midianites. When the angel God sent to talk to him finds him, he's hiding in a pit, a wine press pit. He's trying to shield what he's doing from the Midianites so they don't come in and steal it all after they've gone through all the work of planting and maintaining and harvesting and now processing the harvest. So in Judges 6 and verse 11, it says here, now when the angel of the Eternal came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the wine press in order to hide it from the Midianites. This is not a man that was bold and was going to hit the Midianites head on. He was trying to hide from them. But notice in verse 15, he even says this. This is the viewpoint Gideon has of himself as he responds to God here. He says, oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Who am I? He says, indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh. In the whole tribe, we're nobody. We're at the bottom of the list. And then he says, and indeed, I am in the least of my father's house. So I'm the least of the least, he's saying. God didn't care, did he? He saw something in Gideon. He saw strength that Gideon didn't see. And it's a testament, in my estimation, to Gideon's leadership that he turns around and he manages to have 32,000 men show up to be part of his army. The least of the families in the tribe of Manasseh and the least in his father's household. We'll come back to that in a moment. Let's go next to 2 Corinthians 12. And in verse 10, Paul here is recounting some of his life and some of what God was doing to keep him in the right perspective. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 10, Paul says, therefore, I take pleasure in my infirmities. Paul had a perspective. Who takes pleasure in their infirmities? That's certainly not the world's perspective. Paul's not being weird here. Paul has a perspective that we need to pay attention to. He says, I take pleasure in my infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses. Those seemingly are all negatives, aren't they? Nobody wants to go through reproach. Nobody wants to be in need. Who wants to be persecuted? But notice why he takes pleasure in this. He says, I do it for Christ's sake. And this is the nut of the verse. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Meaning when it looks like I'm at a disadvantage physically, that's when I am at my strongest spiritually. Why is that? Because it's in Christ. It's in God. The strength comes from there. And nobody in the world expects that. Satan, even. It's just astounding to me. As much as he knows God, the Father, that he still thinks he knows better than him. To go back to Gideon's story here, material advantages limit our options. This is a weakness that's going to be the undoing of this country. We trust in money, we trust in resources, we trust in power, we trust in things. And oftentimes those material advantages are actually a weakness. If that's not the case, then why did Gideon succeed? Notice what God did with him. How many guys did Gideon start out with? 32,000. And then he whittled that down very quickly, didn't he? God did. Anybody that's, your heart's not in it, can go home. Anybody who is newly married can go home. And then he takes them down to the river. Anybody that laps like a dog can go home. And he ended up with how many? 300. What are 300 men going to do against the whole army of Midian? And then God leads them into battle with a torch and a pitcher and a trumpet. Are you kidding me? From the world's perspective? If they had seen them at all, they probably would have died of laughing to begin with. But God said, I want them to know, I want you to know, this is not because of your power. It looked weak to the Midianites. Let's go to Ephesians 6. Conquering our spiritual enemies is not about having enough money or resources. It's not about the things that we think would solve the problem from the world's perspective. Ephesians 6 and in verse 10, Paul here talks in this section about the armor of God. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Where is our advantage? Where is our greatest strength? Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. This is why the world doesn't understand why we value God's instruction, follow his word, why we won't work on the Sabbath, why we tithe, why we do all the things we do, because they don't see the strength and the power in God. They see it as a weakness. Verse 11, put on the whole armor of God then, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We can't fight that battle even if we wanted to. Rather, we fight against principalities, against powers, against rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. How in the world could we ever begin on our own to fight Satan? We can't. How do you fight this? What looks like a disadvantage is our advantage. Because we can't, we have the strength in God that will. So verse 13, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. There's an aspect of courage there that we'll come back to here in a moment. But talking about material things and money helping to solve problems, the United States spends more than any other nation currently on military defense. It's a huge amount of money. Depending on how you slice it, it's roughly half of our national money, our budget. But if money makes the difference, then why are we still fighting a war in Afghanistan that was started, what, 2001, 2002? It should have been done long ago. Why are we still fighting basically a proxy war, stalemate, in North Korea, the Korean Peninsula? That goes back to the late 1950s. That one's still not done. There's a business parallel to this as well. From one generation to the next, how effective they are. It's not just about money. It's not just about market share. It's not about the things they trust in. What is the success rate of a company from one generation to the next? A lot of people tend to think that it's high because we see companies like GM or Ford or GE or Microsoft or, you know, name your companies. But less than one-third of businesses survive the transition to the second generation. Less than a third. And then if you take it to the third generation, less than 50% of that third. So we're talking 15% of the original number. Less than 15% survive to the third generation. And there are a number of reasons why, but some of the few and more salient ones are lack of passion, lack of knowledge, and lack of sacrifice. There are giants facing the youth in the church. You have giants. All of us do. How are you going to fight them to succeed? It might look like you need all kinds of things you don't have and you see yourselves at great disadvantage. How do you stand up to a teacher or a professor that says they're going to flunk you if you do not take this test during the feast? How are you going to fight them? We fight giants by not doing the obvious. Lack of passion is not solved by trying to take on someone else's passion. You can't do it. It's solved by finding your own passion. Each generation has to know and articulate the values that give success. Those companies that succeed past the third generation have done that. Each generation articulates the values that give success. It's going to morph. It has to, because life is not static. But if it's maintained and built on those same values, then they can succeed. Jesus Christ, in his day, as a human man, was rejected in part because he was not part of the established institutions. They derided him because he didn't go to certain rabbinical schools, or he was not of the priesthood, or he was not of this family, or he was not of this tribe. The priesthood of that time had become the third generation of a failing business, and they couldn't see it. They hated Christ for healing on the Sabbath. Why would you hate someone for doing such an amazing thing? Well, because they saw it as work. They had become so regimented in their view of God that they lost the passion. They lost the drive. They never questioned if this type of work, to put it in quotes, this work qualified by glorifying God to be okay. God gave all kinds of things that were, I don't want to say excuses, the things that were okay. Your animal is in a ditch on the Sabbath day. Take care of it. Don't leave it there. If your neighbor is in distress, help them. These sort of things. God says it's just common sense. Healing would be a very similar thing. Why would you not do that? But we can fall into this mentality in the church if we're not careful. We have in our history. Mr. Dave Roensby pastored down Beloit and Wisconsin Dells for a while. And I got to know him fairly well because of proximity. We would have lunch with Mr. Bob Fay on a regular basis. And when Mr. Roensby was in the hospital, not expecting to die, he was in very good spirits and he was telling stories. He was relating a lot of church history to me that I didn't know. For those of you that don't know, Mr. Roensby grew up in Pasadena. He grew up a lot of these men at headquarters. And he told me a story when he was a young man on one of the holy days. I don't remember which one he mentioned. He was a row or so removed, but fairly close to a man that Mr. Armstrong called up to be ordained an evangelist. And quite the honor, recognition. This man goes up. Mr. Armstrong ordains him. This man comes back after all that, sits down at his seat, pulls out his Bible, turns to the back of it. He had a list of positions in the church. And he crossed off evangelist. Matthew 20, verse 25. He became like the ruler of the Gentiles. He thought his advantage was moving up in the church. He thought his advantage was recognition. He thought his strength was a title. But those type of men stopped fighting spiritual giants against the accepted worldly approach. They ceased to put Christ first. And so his advantage became a huge disadvantage Because when he ran out of those positions, and when he ran out of the recognition, and when it ran into an aspect of having to stand firm on God's truth, he couldn't. Let's go back to 2 Corinthians 12, and I want to read a little bit more there before the verse we read earlier. 2 Corinthians 12, and I want to begin in verse 7 this time, because there's another thing to consider here. 2 Corinthians, if I said first, I apologize. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, Paul says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations." Paul knew. By this point in his life, Paul knew these letters of his were being circulated. Paul could see his own effort, if you will, in serving God. All the churches that he established, all the different places of the world he went to, the miracles that were done. I mean, you go down the list of when he had to defend his apostleship, the times he was in the deep, as he says, the times that he was beaten, the times that he was in prison. He stood out, didn't he? And the danger humanly is that we can begin to believe our own press, as we say, think we're better than we are. And he's acknowledging this, and he says, "Unless I should be exalted above measure of the abundance of these revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me." We don't know what that thorn was. Many have speculated it was his vision, but nonetheless, whatever it was, it bothered him. What was his giant? Well, this trial certainly was a giant. It says, "A messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me." I mentioned earlier, I asked the question, what are your giants? What are the trials you're going through? Jobs or family or money or health or whatever. Paul went through this. How long have you pleaded with God? Paul says he pleaded three times. I don't think that was an exclusive number. I think it was specific to a specific prayer. But notice what God says, verse 9, "My grace is sufficient to you." That's a soft no. No, I'm not going to heal you. But notice why. He just didn't tell him no and walk away. He told him, "No, I'm not going to do that." He says, "For my strength is made perfect in weakness. Your disadvantage is my advantage." We'll come back to that in a moment as well. So Paul then, with what God says, "Therefore, most gladly, I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me." The race is not to the swift or to the strong. Paul began to see by this point that what God was allowing in his life was actually giving him a huge advantage, because it kept him focused, didn't it, on the right things, that his strength, as it says above, was in God. That's seen again as a disadvantage to the world, but it was every advantage Paul needed. He even acknowledged at the end of verse 10, after saying he's not going to, he rather takes pleasures in infirmities and reproaches and so forth. He says, "For when I am weak, then I am strong." That's an underdog, isn't it? That's flipping everything on its head. That looks like no advantage whatsoever. The husband and wife psychologist team of Robert and Elizabeth Bork penned a phrase called desirable difficulties. They penned that phrase to explain why sometimes a disadvantage can be desirable. We don't like to think that way humanly. We like comfort, and we like peace. We like an absence of strife and all these things. When can a difficulty become desirable? How can that be? Well, to follow up on that, there's a Yale professor named Shane Frederick, and he invented the world's shortest intelligence test. So here's a little bit more of audience participation here. It's three questions. This test is as effective as tests that will take hours and hours to take and hundreds of questions long. And it's three simple questions. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Second question. If it takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? Third question. In a lake, there's a patch of lily pads. Every day, the patch doubles in size. If it takes 48 days for the patch to cover an entire lake, how many days would it take for the patch to cover half the lake? The highest score on this test went to a group of college students at MIT. They scored an average score of 2.18 correct answers. So 2.18 out of 3. Psychologists Adam Outler and Daniel Oppenheimer found that they could raise the average score on this test by making it harder. How do you make it harder? They didn't add questions. They didn't change the questions. So how do you make it harder? They printed the questions in 10% gray, 10-point italic font on paper. It's like ghosting. And then they gave the test to another set of college students. This made, as you can imagine, the questions very hard to read. And so they found the test takers slowed down. They had to read it and reread it. They had to pause, go back, and start over. Their average test score rose to 2.45 compared to 2.18 for MIT students just by slowing down and rereading it. Desirable difficulty made it more effective. Sometimes something that is really hard for us, even spiritually, that causes us to slow down and think about what is going on actually helps us to be a better son or daughter of God. Now, I'll answer those questions for you so you don't have to wonder. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than a ball. How much does the ball cost? $1.05. If the bat costs $1 more than the ball, it has to be $1.05. The ball costs 5 cents, so the 5 cents cancel out. It's $1 more. If it takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long does it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? We think we have to multiply 5 up to 100. The machines are still making the same number of widgets in the same amount of time. You just have more machines. So it's still 5 minutes. The third question was, in a lake, there's a patch of lily pads. Every day, the patch doubles in size. If it takes 48 days for the patch to cover the entire lake, how many days would it take for the patch to cover half the lake? We tend to think you have the days. So it's 24 days to cover half a lake. Nope, that's not right. It's 47 days because on day 48, it doubles and it covers the lake. What trial, what spiritual fight have you gone through in your life that has forced you to slow down and really think and ponder what God is doing in your life? Have you ever considered it to be a desirable difficulty? We're inconvenienced. We're upset. We're oftentimes mad at the things that go wrong in our lives. What now? You got to be kidding me. Why do the guys that do all the wrong things prosper? That was David's lament, wasn't it? That's a different way of looking at it. But what if God is setting you up for success? Instead of looking at the trial as a problem, instead of David looking at Goliath as something unsurmountable, it was simply something that God would use him to accomplish. What if being an underdog because we don't have money, or maybe we're not the most gifted in some area of life, or that we've not been called by God for a very long time, or we're young in the faith, physically, spiritually. What if all those things and more were actually helping us to be better in our spiritual battles? Our seeming disadvantages being some of the strongest advantages we have. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 1. A big part of what I'm talking about here today is conquering fear. And 2 Timothy 1 verse 7 addresses this. Paul writes to Timothy here, he says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." David didn't fear Goliath. In the end, Gideon didn't fear the Midianites. Christ didn't fear the religious authorities of his day. We have no reason to fear because that's not of God. Our seeming disadvantages are not weaknesses. God gives us, as it says here, power, love, sound mind. Those are huge advantages, aren't they? because those are things that will lead us into his family, into his kingdom. To consider this matter of fear, there's an interesting phenomenon that takes place. During World War II, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill feared that the Germans would bomb London. And it was a very prime target. It would be a huge propaganda coup for Hitler to be able to bomb Britain. At that time was their closest, biggest enemy. And Churchill also feared that if Germans started bombing London on a regular basis, that it would collapse the will of the British people to fight. Not just in London, that this would ripple out and affect the whole war effort. They would be crippled with fear, he feared. But the amazing thing is that that paralyzing fear never materialized. The Germans did bomb London and bombed on a regular basis to a point where there were bomb craters everywhere. Incendiary bombs had burned out huge sections of the city, rubble on every block. Millions of people lost their homes. A full night of sleep was impossible. The German bombing went on for 4.5 months. After the war, there was a Canadian psychiatrist, J.T. McCurdy, that studied this phenomenon. Why did they not collapse from fear? Why did all of that not happen? He divided the population into three groups, and he came to the conclusion that the morale of the community depended upon the reaction of the survivors. So these three groups he divided up were the people killed. Those didn't factor into it because they're dead. There's no fear. They're gone. The other two groups he called the near misses and the remote misses. The near misses were those that had been hurt by the bombing. A relative that was killed, their home was destroyed, something along that line created a deep negative impression, and now they had great fear. The third group is the remote misses, and he found that those were those who, for the most part, were unaffected by the bombing. They didn't know people personally affected by it, people that had been killed, their homes weren't destroyed, things of that nature. And so the curious thing that happened is the more bombings that happened, and they being unaffected, they began to develop a sense of being impervious. I'm safe. Even though these bombs are raining down, I'm not going to be hurt. They became, in other words, unafraid of being afraid. This became courage, and it was actually the opposite of what the Germans had hoped would happen and what Churchill feared would happen. Courage can also be a realization that the tough times are not so tough after all. We can see this through. The underdog can consistently win. As an underdog, we've been through a lot in our spiritual calling. Have we been through enough spiritual battles that we are unafraid of being afraid? Let's look at a couple of verses to conclude here. Let's go, depending on your Bible, up the page, over the page. 1 Timothy 6, verse 12. 1 Timothy 6, verse 12. Paul writes here again, "Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life." Part of the advantage that we have as an underdog is that not only do we not have to fight the way the world, the way Satan expects us to fight, but we also know what we're fighting for, and we also know how God wants us to fight. We know the end of it all, the reward that God is offering, the hope that we have. Fight the good fight of faith through God, drawing on his power, as we read earlier. He says, "To which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses." Hebrews 12, verse 1. We can personalize that even closer. The ones that have gone before us here in our lives, we know their witness. We see their example. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy 4, verse 7. Paul here towards the end of his life, he wrote these letters not knowing how long he would live. He did not live very long after this. And so this is probably somewhere around 65 AD. And he's sort of looking back on his life and he's pondering. And that can be a very fearful thing for some people. Have I done enough? Am I good enough? Have I overcome enough will God have me in his family? And Paul didn't have that fear. We don't have to have that fear. Paul says, I have fought the good fight. David fought a good fight. Noah fought a good fight. How do you preach for 120 years and nobody shows up on the boat? Moses, 40 years, herding cats. I mean, I don't know how he survived that. You fought the good fight. Look at what's going on in your life. You know that better than anyone, the struggles that you've been through, what God has helped you to overcome. Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. As an underdog, it didn't matter how he did that. The fact that he did is all that matters. He had every disadvantage from the world, didn't he? We do as well. This world is not primed to help us succeed in our calling. But God is there with us. Paul says, I've finished the race. We are in a spiritual battle. And it's only going to get worse as the end time progresses. We're underdogs compared to everything the world around us is and does. We are underdogs, but we are God's underdogs. I was given a saying by someone after the sermon this morning that I'll include here. It says, don't tell God how large or how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big your God is. We are fighting for a spiritual reward pictured in the upcoming holy days. If the world truly understood what that meant, what those days mean, what would they give for it? It's beyond price, isn't it? It's ours for the having if we're in the fight, if we change and overcome, we take on God's nature. If we fight that fight the way he wants us to, now is the time to draw near to God and engage in these spiritual battles as he would have us to fight. It is every advantage we have to be an underdog. The success is ours if we're engaged in the battle. And I've read to the end of the story, and the underdogs win.